It's All Things Considered on North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. I'm Jeff Tabiri. Each Friday at this time, we review the week in state politics with perspectives from the right and the left. Becky Gray is Senior Vice President and a lobbyist with the conservative John Locke Foundation. Rob Schofield is Director of Research at NC Policy Watch, a division of the progressive North Carolina Justice Center. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jeff.
Following last week's House Bill 2 compromise, lawmakers turned their attention to a number of other notable issues, including tax cuts, environmental regulations, executive authority, Board of Governors elections, state courts, and school calendars. Becky, let's start with you. What's your story of the week? Doesn't have to be one of those.
Well, I think the story of the week, again, moving from not talking about bathrooms anymore, thank goodness, moving on to taxes. I think that the Senate tax plan is really the news of the week. They continue to talk about the $1 billion tax cut that they are offering. I think it's interesting on a couple points. First of all, 99% of personal income taxpayers will either get a tax cut or pay no taxes at all with the increase in the zero tax bracket. It's very good news for taxpayers. I also think it's interesting, and there's kind of a story there, that the Senate has started out the budget process by talking about cuts in taxes before they talk about sort of the wish list of what they want to pay for, you know, what government's going to look like. It's sort of flip-flopped what we usually see along those lines. So I think that's kind of it's a comment on the priorities that we're seeing in the Senate. Now, interestingly enough, the House has also come out this week and said, in spite of their initial more modest tax reduction proposal, they may come out with something that's even bigger than the Senate is. This whole notion of cutting taxes, rolling back regulation, smarter investments in education and infrastructure are really resonating with the growth of the economy that we've had. And so I think this is a very good sign for North Carolina.
It strikes me that the differing House and Senate proposals likely are going to head to closed-door debate and negotiations later this year. Is that your read on it?
Well, of course, and that's always part of the budget process, and that the governor does the first pass at it, kind of sets out his priorities. The House or Senate takes turns proposing their budget, then the other body does their budget, and then the final product really is a combination of all of those. And a lot of those, you're right, Jeff, is worked out behind closed doors. But many of these things have been discussed for months. So we'll have an idea as we go through this process.
Not to get too wonky with proposed tax policy, but I'm interested if you have a preference or a priority. When we think about the Senate proposal that advanced through that chamber this week, there were three primary pieces of that. I believe, if I can do it off the top of my head, lowers the personal income tax rate to 5.35, the corporate to 2.75, and increases the standard deduction for married couples filing jointly to $20,000.
Right. Ask me to pick, because it's a package.
You have to.
It's a package.
One, two,
and it's a balance. I guess if I had to prioritize the package, I would say that the personal income tax, because just about every North Carolinian is affected by that. I really like the increase in the standard deduction, the zero tax bracket, because that helps low-income families the most. And then also the corporate tax. I think that's important, too, to increase the visibility and the attractiveness of North Carolina for businesses to come here, businesses to grow here, to create jobs, to get more people working so that they can provide for their families without having to be dependent on government. So it really is. I mean, all kidding aside, it really is a package, and all of those are important to have that balance in that tax package. And then, of course, on the other side of it, you always have to remember with that comes smarter government spending, really identifying the core functions of government and prioritizing those things on the other end and letting people keep more of their money that they earned that belongs to them to spend the way that they want to.
Rob, I didn't forget about you. We're going to talk about your legislative story of the week in just a moment. But first, as the conversation is flowing, a rebuttal to any of that, your...
How much time do I have?
Well, I'll give you a couple minutes.
I'm just joking.
And maybe something you like as well in the Senate tax proposal.
I would actually say none of the above.
None of the above.
I would
say
this is one of the most dangerous proposals that we've seen in the legislature this year. Governor Cooper was speaking this week to a group of businessmen in the Triangle, businessmen and women, and asked them for their help in defeating this because he rightfully pointed out a lot of things about it. Number one is that with the new administration in Washington and the new world order that we have in Washington, we know almost to a certainty that we're going to get less money from the federal government, whether it's for health care, any number of revenue sharing items. So right off the top, you're already taking money out of our available resources. North Carolina is already spending only about 85 cents on the dollar as to what it was spending 5 or 6 years ago. And it's no surprise, therefore, that lots of our critical essential services are in desperate straits, most notably public education, which continues to suffer mightily. We had Guilford County lay off 50 TAs this week because of these new policies on reducing class size at the lower level. So we desperately need more resources, not less. The notion that before we even know what's going to happen in Washington, before we even know how the current tax structure that we've adopted over recent years performs during a downturn, which is going to happen at some point. We haven't had one since a national downturn since these were adopted. This is the absolute last time to embark upon a new billion-dollar tax cut, especially given the fact that notwithstanding the language about, oh, we're going to raise the standard deduction, the reality is that the vast majority continues to go to the wealthy and to profitable corporations and not to people of modest means. And so all across the board, this is probably the worst idea that the legislature has so far this year, and I think it would be behooves us to slow it down and to really think twice, especially if we're going to go down this road of making constitutional changes when it comes to tax structure. We don't even know how the tax cuts we've implemented the last few years are really going to perform. Not the time to adopt more of them.
Again, in terms of the timing piece of this, I think it is worth noting it came out of the Senate this week. The House introduced its own tax cut proposal last month. I think it was last month now. They will perhaps tweak that, as you noted, and this is something that will head to conference, we expect, in May, June, and July. Rob, I didn't forget about that first initial question I asked. The most important development at the legislature this week was what?
I think it was really the tax debate is part of it. There was this sort of across-the-board reiteration of the dominant philosophy in the General Assembly these days, particularly from the Senate side, of sort of this hyper-partisan, ends justify the means, no prisoners approach to lawmaking. On issue after issue, you ticked off some of the issues. We could look at the Board of Governors. We could look at deregulation. We could look at hog waste. We could look at class size. A whole raft of issues. The approach is we're going to develop these things behind closed doors, and then we're going to roll them out, and we're going to ram them through. They don't bring in experts to hear, even on the tax matter. They'll allow people to come and testify for a minute or two. That was the same sort of approach we saw to HB2. But we're seeing it on all kinds of issues now. The notion that our committee meetings don't bring in experts, we don't hear from academics, or a classic example was this week we took a move to shrink our state court of appeals. We had a Republican court of appeals judge come in and say, pardon me, these numbers you're using to make these determinations on the number of cases we hear, they're actually wrong by a large number. One of our folks at Policy Watch reported that this week. She was summarily ignored. There was just no attention given to that. They cut her off. And that is the approach that's being taken. These folks have a different vision of what they want North Carolina to look like, and they are pursuing it and not terribly interested in dialogue about how it gets done.
Specific to the courts, if we can stick with that for just a moment, and your colleague Rick Glaser in that seat previously has said he expects there to be a court packing scheme in the next year or two, or the legislators, the General Assembly, would expand the state Supreme Court. So if we're talking about two courts here, the state Supreme Court, 7 members, the state appellate court, 15. Are you of the mind that they're good where they are, that they need to be grown, they need to expand, or that they – I don't think you're of the mind they need to shrink?
If anything, the Court of Appeals is – the judges are – as the judge testified yesterday, earlier this week, Judge Stroud – They're overworked now. The state has grown tremendously. We're an ever more litigious state. They have lots to do. And the notion that we're going to shrink the Court of Appeals from 15 to 12, this has nothing to do with the legislators really thinking that the numbers justify it. This is about the fact that they want to keep the court more in control of Republicans. It's Republican-dominated now, but the next 3 judges who are scheduled to retire are all Republicans, and they don't want Governor Cooper appointing Democrats to take the place of those 3 judges.
But to be fair and for context, this Court of Appeals went from 12 to 15 under Democratic rule. Isn't this just a game that is played, and whoever's in power, they're going to tweak things and they're going to do what they can to maintain power?
If you look at the numbers, I mean, North Carolina has grown tremendously. Now, the Court of Appeals doesn't sit like the Supreme Court as one body together. At least it doesn't very often. Now we have a law that allows it in some instances. we've got many more cases than we had 20 years ago. Yes, the court was expanded from 12 to 15, I guess, in 2000, but that's not out of proportion. And if there was partisan aspects to it, which I'm sure there always are when these decisions get made, just because that was so doesn't mean we double down on this. This is taking it to a new level. To actually shrink a court, no other court in the country is going this direction. No other state in the country is going this direction. And, of course, this just goes hand in glove with the decision to make our lower court voting completely partisan. It's driven entirely by partisan objectives, has nothing to do with the numbers, has nothing to do with the actual caseload or workload of the courts.
Becky, you've been patient.
Just a couple points with it. This has happened on both sides. I mean, if you look back at the history of North Carolina and the courts, and as it grows and it shrinks and all of this, the option that you mentioned of packing the Supreme Court, which I think you're referring to, there's an option out there to add additional members to mm-hmm. the Supreme Court that was set aside years ago. This isn't something that Republicans have just put into place. It's an option that they may or may not take up. I don't know. We're hearing that it might be considered. It was considered, I think, back in the fall.
Right.
But nothing has been done on that. But the option was set up under Democrats. So I think, you know, Rob's right. I mean, this constant harping on partisan things I don't think really helps anyone. And looking at the courts, what the workload is, how those things flow, there are some other types of cases that they will redirect to the Supreme Court, changing things a little bit. What I'm hearing from the discussions that have occurred in the committee and around these kind of bills is making the courts receptive, making it work better, making it work quicker so that people's cases are decided in a more timely fashion, and putting the personnel where it's needed is really what is behind this. And there have been opinions, data calculated of cases that are done, how long they take, those kind of things that have driven these decisions.
But if that were so, wouldn't you bring in the court officials themselves, the administrators, the judges, to get their opinion on how things are working right now in the court system? And that was something that was simply not done. It just points out the fact this is driven by partisanship and by ideology and by party. It's not driven by the actual needs of the court.
Well, I'm not sure that that's really, that everyone would interpret it that way. I mean, there was a tremendous amount of data that was collected on the different cases, what that looked like over a period of years, where the trends seemed to be as they were making these decisions on how to reallocate the personnel in the court system.
But the numbers that Representative Stevens cited in the case in the committee hearing on Wednesday were shown to be completely inaccurate. They were not consistent with what the court has reported, and that calls out for sober testimony. Let's actually take a few hours. Let's have some experts come in and opine. Let's hear what other states are doing. Let's not just spring something in a, you know, a 45-minute committee meeting in which people are given 1 minute to speak. That's just not a good way to make such fundamental changes to basic state law.
And a lot of that information gathering is not just done at the committee level. It's done as these things are drafted, as the decisions are being considered and vetted and all of that. And I know that there was a tremendous amount of information that went into these decisions.
I will say this, and I plead novice ignorance on some things, certainly less experience than either of you and most of my press colleagues at the General Assembly. It seems to me almost without fail that big things that move through that building, through both chambers, and I haven't been there under Democratic rule. I don't know if it would be the same or not. My hunch is that it would be. Big things that move in that building move quickly. There's not slow, deliberate conversation on a lot of the bigger things. That's just my perception, my observation of things. Now, maybe they have to. Go ahead.
Let me give you an example how it actually has changed in recent years.
Okay.
One of my colleagues wrote a piece today on NC Policy Watch earlier this week, actually, Chris Nordstrom, who used to work at the legislature, and he wrote about the fact that the Education Oversight Committee and the Joint Appropriations Committees that consider education appropriations used to meet quite regularly, even early in the Republican rule. In recent years, through the early days of session, they heard nonpartisan expert testimony from the state agencies. They came in, they looked at the numbers, the data, they crunched things. They had, you know, boring hearing after boring hearing in which matters were seriously considered. That was always the way the budgets were drafted. At least that's how the process ran in the early days when the Democrats were in control. I've been here 25 years. It has changed now. The Education Appropriations Committee hadn't had any testimony like that on the K-12 budget. Ed Oversight has met one time in the last year. Things have changed very subtly, but gradually and significantly in recent years. More and more you can say that they're collecting the data themselves, but they're not doing it in public, and they're springing these things on people at the last minute. And that's a negative for the people. It's a negative for conservatives and liberals and for openness in our government.
Well, I will tell you, I've been down there a lot. There are plenty of dull, boring meetings where
that's
there's
true.
Lots of dull information that's provided.
But
you know, to all of these
like
appropriations committees, I mean, we heard, you know, tons of testimony and explanation of the governor's budget and going through all of that with those numbers and those calculations. And, you know, we'll see that with the Senate budget, that it'll all be discussed and all the numbers, you know, every single one of those numbers and those meetings are hours and hours long. And with education being 57,
no,
there are amendments that are offered. Those subcommittee meetings often go on for hours with, I don't know that there are hundreds of amendments, but there are close to 100 amendments often in those, particularly the education part of the budget. The education part of the budget is 57% of our state budget. There's a lot of discussion and vetting of that.
This will likely be for our web version of this, and we'll let the listeners in on a little bit of a secret. Not that much of a secret, which is we record this on Thursdays. And during our recording this week, there was a stoppage in our conversation. And at that point, I picked up my cell phone to check my text messages. This was at the juncture where we were talking about things moving through quickly. And I had text messages from both of my colleagues, Jess Clark and Rusty Jacobs, who are in the legislature, at the legislature at this moment, which is Thursday. You're hearing it on Friday or later. And the text message reads, "Something weird happened with House Bill 467, the hog bill. It passed second reading without debate or objection. Moore rammed it through. A lot of reps were puzzled. He said he saw no lights on, so no debate was allowed. There was no third reading." I believe third reading was objected to. Mm-hmm. React to that for me, if you would.
If it's true, that is symptomatic of, I think, a subtle but distinct trend in the General Assembly in recent years. We are seeing more and more of this kind of stuff. The folks who are driving the train at the General Assembly have a very concrete idea of where they want to take the state. It's very much analogous to the rule change in Washington to get Neil Gorsuch on the Supreme Court. The rules are getting changed gradually but noticeably in order to get an agenda through, and they're not terribly concerned about the niceties of process anymore.
Jeff, I would just add to that, this is, of course, the bill that would lift some of the restrictions on the environmental regulations around the hog farms, if I've got the bill in the context correctly. And I think this is problematic. I think that transparency is important. I think it's transparency and open government is important no matter who's in charge. And when you have these very controversial issues where there have been questions that have been driven of perhaps campaign contributions, of other things, and that has all been in the news in the last week, I think it's problematic.
We agree.
Thanks for weighing in. And, you know, there's always middle ground if you chat long enough. Another verdict on redistricting came this week. Federal Judge Catherine Eagles ruled that a state law from 2015 seeking to redraw Greensboro City Council districts amounted to unconstitutional racial gerrymandering. This follows court decisions striking down congressional boundaries, state legislative districts, and redistricting efforts in Wake County. All of the maps for those were drawn by members of the General Assembly. Seems like a pattern. What do you make of it?
The whole question of redistricting, Jeff, for me, the real problem is that the rules of how to do redistricting are not really clear. We have seen this under Democrat control when they were drawing the maps, when they were gerrymandering the maps. We have seen this under Republican control when they have drawn the maps and they have gerrymandered the maps. There's a lot of discussion about an independent commission doing this a different way, taking the politics out of it. I'm not sure how you take the politics out of redistricting. I mean, it is the most political thing that the General Assembly does. In my mind, the real answer to this is the rules that are in place that control how redistricting is done, so that there is less room for wiggle room to change things. To me, it doesn't make as much difference who draws the maps as the rules that control how those maps are drawn. And what we're seeing with these court cases, every one of these, is they go through the courts and the courts make the determination. The courts are drawing those rules of how the maps can and cannot be drawn the next time. So it's a very expensive and it is a very obviously litigious way to develop those rules of how to do redistricting. But I think it's important to develop those rules, and that's where we're going with it.
I generally agree. I think it has gotten even more egregious in recent years. The Democrats were clearly guilty of gerrymandering when they were in control. I think the Republicans have perfected it. They've taken it to a new level. It's along the lines of the same ends justify the means discussion we were having earlier about the policies that are being passed at the General Assembly. The hope I have is that, as with so many other issues these days, the courts are eventually going to be forced to step in. There is this very promising idea, a lawsuit brought by Common Cause and others, to challenge the very concept of partisan gerrymandering, not just racial gerrymandering, but the whole idea that you can draw maps intentionally to favor your own party. It deprives many people of a valuable vote, a meaningful vote. And so I'm very hopeful that that's ultimately going to be the solution. It is very difficult to craft a working, nonpartisan solution. But there are ways. There are states clearly that do a better job than North Carolina. Iowa is often held up as an example, an imperfect one, but definitely better than North Carolina. We've got to move in that direction, or we're going to just lose public faith in government altogether.
Rob Schofield is Director of Research at NC Policy Watch. Becky Gray is Senior Vice President at the John Locke Foundation. Thanks for the conversation.
Thanks,
Jeff.
This conversation was recorded at our studio in downtown Raleigh at the Natural Sciences Museum. To hear a longer version of our discussion or share with your social media friends and followers, visit our website, wunc.org.